And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, we have been talking about a lot of things. Federal Trade Commission has made a list of several. There's a Social Security scam where scammers pretend to be from the Social Security Administration. In fact, I got one of those calls. They said it was a recorded call, and they said my Social Security number had been frozen because of what appeared to be improper activity, and push one to talk to an individual about it. And he was going to do all these wonderful things. And, of course, it was a scam. And then there's IRS scammers. They say they're from the IRS. And unless you pay the amount due, they're going to send somebody out to arrest you. And usually they want you to go to Walmart and get a gift card and read the number to them over the phone, and that'll pay your taxes. And then there's email or text messages you might get to try to get you to give personal information. And then, of course, there's every day I have an email from somebody who was an official with some bank who wants me to let them transfer money into my account, and for letting them use my account, I'll get 40%. And it's usually millions of dollars. I got one today. Then there's a real estate and investment scam. They promise to teach people how to make lots of money quickly and easily, usually by investing in real estate. And then, of course, there's scams disguised as legitimate business offers, coaching programs, investment opportunities. And, of course, you get calls from Apple and Amazon support. My wife, who does not have an account with Apple, gets one every week or so that she's delinquent on her Apple account, and she needs to send X amount of dollars to by clicking on this link. And then there's and scammers, of course, follow the headlines. They take advantage of what's happening in the news. Cleaning supplies have been in high demand and short supply, and scammers see that as an opportunity, and they offer to let you get in on the ground floor of a new cleaning product. And then there's the COVID-19 clinical trial. Thousands of trials are underway, of course, as companies try to find effective vaccines. And many of the research studies are legitimate, but some aren't. So if you want to volunteer for one, you need to make sure that it's a real trial and not one that requires you to give all this personal information and they use it to sell on the dark web. And then you might get a robocall that you paid too much on a utility bill. To make up for the mistake, you'll get a cash refund and a discount on your future bills. All you have to do is click one or click two, and variation on that. You're behind on your utility bills. You didn't pay what you should have paid. So they're going to cut your utilities off unless you click one or two and give them a credit card over the phone. Then, and of course, we have the imposter scam. I got one yesterday from the head of the FBI. And he had confirmed that I really was going to get money from a Nigerian prince. And it's been put on an ATM card, and he wanted me to know that that ATM card was legitimate. All I had to do was pay a processing fee. And sometimes these scammers ask you to transfer money from your bank or using a wire company like Western Union or MoneyGram, or put it on a gift card. And then, of course, you get a call from somebody who pretends to be, or it may be an email or a text, It's somebody you know because they've hacked into your contacts. And they have been arrested or some other problem. They need you to send money. We were friends with one of the presenters on QVC. And while we were watching them present something, we got a text that they were in jail in Belgium, I think. And we needed to send $1,500 to help them get out. And then there's the stimulus check fraud. There's a crook for around every corner. So you just need to be careful. Well, today's December the 4th, 338th day of the year. 27 days remain until the end of the year. In leap years, it's 339th day. On this date in history, in 771, Austrasian King Carloman I dies. His brother Charlemagne is king of the Frankish kingdom, as it's called. In 1110, the kingdom of Jerusalem captures Sidon. Now, during the Crusades, the First Crusade was highly successful. And they actually captured Jerusalem, and it became an independent kingdom with a French noble as king. That is still a hereditary title, King of Jerusalem. In 1259, King Louis IX of France and Henry III of England agreed to the Treaty of Paris, in which Henry renounces his claims to French-controlled territory on the continent of Europe in exchange for Louis withdrawing his support for English rebels. In 1563, the final session of the Council of Trent is held. It opened on December 13th, 1545, so it had been going on quite some time. In 1619, 38 colonists arrived at Berkeley 100 in Virginia. The group's charter proclaimed that the day be yearly and perpetually kept holy as a day of thanksgiving to Almighty God. Berkeley 100, for those that are not familiar with it, is the Virginia colony comprised of about 8,000 acres on the north bank of the James River. It's in an area then known as Charles City. It became known as Berkeley Plantation, and it was the home of the Harrison family, one of the first families of Virginia. It was a land grant, actually, in 1618 to Sir William Throckmorton, Sir George Yardley, and George Thorpe, Richard Berkeley, and John Smith. It was quite an interesting setup. There were several of these land grants. My family had one. 1676, the Danish army under the command of King Christian V engages the Swedish army commanded by the Swedish King Charles XI at the Battle of Lund. And to this day, it's counted as the bloodiest battle in Scandinavian history and a turning point in the Scandinavian War. 1745. Okay, everybody and their dog wants to sell me something. And unfortunately, because I get news updates that I may want to give you, I can't cut off this system while I'm on the air. 1745, Charles Edward Stuart's army reaches Derby, its furthest point during the Second Jacobite Rising. 1783, at Fonce's Tavern in New York City, George Washington bids farewell to his officers. 1786, Mission Santa Barbara is dedicated on the feast day of St. Barbara. 1791, first edition of The Observer, the world's first Sunday newspaper, is published. 1829, in the face of fierce local opposition, British Governor General Lord William Bentinck issues a regulation declaring anybody who abets a suttee in Bengal is guilty of culpable homicide. Now, for those that are not familiar with the term, suttee is a historical practice found chiefly among Hindus in the northern regions of South Asia in which a widow sacrifices herself by climbing up on top of her deceased husband's funeral fire. Now, we really don't know how extensive this practice was in history, but during the early Mughal period, it was associated with elite Hindu Rajput clans in Western India. And there were a number of deaths, and the British tried to stamp out the practice. And anybody who helped the widow do it was kind of, basically it was the federal, similar to the felony murder rule here in the U.S. If you're involved in a crime and somebody's killed, it's considered a felony murder. 1861, 109 electors of the Confederate States of America unanimously elect Jefferson Davis as president, Alexander Stevens as vice president. 1864, American Civil War, Sherman's march to the sea. At Waynesboro, Georgia, forces under Union General Kilpatrick prevent troops led by Confederate General Wheeler, who was basically a very effective cavalry commander with the Confederacy, from interfering with General Sherman's campaign, destroying a wide swath of the South on his march to the Atlantic Ocean from Atlanta. 1865, North Carolina ratifies the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, followed soon by Georgia, and U.S. slaves are legally free within 2 weeks. 1867, former Minnesota farmer Oliver Kelly founds the Order of Patrons of Husbandry, better known today as the Grange. 1872, the crewless American brigantine Mary Celeste drifting in the Atlantic is discovered by the Canadian brig De Gracia. Ship had been abandoned for 9 days, but was only slightly damaged. Her master, Benjamin Briggs, and all 9 others known to have been on board are never accounted for. Among those on board were his wife and daughter. No one has ever determined what happened to the crew of the Mary Celeste. 1875, notorious New York City politician Boss Tweed escapes from prison. He's recaptured in Spain. 1881, the first edition of the Los Angeles Times is published. 1893, first Matabele War. Patrol of 34 British South African Company soldiers is ambushed and annihilated by more than 3,000 Matabele warriors on the Shanghai River in Matabele Land. 1906, Alpha Phi Alpha, the first black intercollegiate Greek lettered fraternity, is founded at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. 1909, in Canadian football, the first Grey Cup game is played. University of Toronto Varsity Blues defeat the Toronto Parkdale Canoe Club 26-6. 1909, the Montreal Canadiens Ice Hockey Club, the oldest surviving professional hockey franchise in the world, is founded as a charter member of the National Hockey Association. 1918, President Woodrow Wilson sails for the World War I peace talks in Versailles, becoming the first U.S. president to travel to Europe while in office. 1939, World War II, HMS Nelson is struck by a mine laid by the U-boat U-31 off the Scottish coast, and it has to be laid up for repairs till August 1940. 1942, World War II, Carlson's patrol during the Guadalcanal campaign ends. Now, for those that are not familiar with Carlson's patrol, also known as the Long Patrol, was an operation by the 2nd Marine Raider Battalion under the command of Evans Carlson during the Guadalcanal campaign against the Japanese Army. In the operation, the 2nd Raiders attacked forces under the command of Toshinori Soji, who were escaping from an attempted encirclement in the Kali Point area of Guadalcanal, trying to rejoin other Japanese Army units on the opposite side of the U.S. Lunga perimeter. In a series of small unit engagements that lasted over 29 days, 2nd Raiders killed almost 500 Japanese soldiers while suffering over 16 killed, although a number are afflicted by disease. They also captured a Japanese field gun that was delivering harassing fire on Henderson Field, which was the Allied airfield at the Lunga Point. It was quite an interesting operation. 1943, in Yugoslavia, resistance leader Marshal Josip Broz Tito proclaims a provisional democratic Yugoslav government in exile. 1943, President Roosevelt closes down the Works Progress Administration because of the high levels of wartime employment in the United States. Work's Progress Administration was designed initially to create jobs, but there were so many jobs during the war that it wasn't needed anymore. 1945, by a vote of 65-7, the U.S. Senate approves U.S. participation in the United Nations. The UN had been established October 24, 1945. It basically replaced the worthless League of Nations. 1949, Sir Duncan George Stewart was fatally stabbed by Rosalie Dobie, a member leader of the Rukun 13 in Sibu, Sarawak, Malaysia, during the British Crown Colony era in that state. 1956, the Million Dollar Quartet. Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, and Johnny Cash get together at Sun Studios for the first and the last time. 1964, the Free Speech Movement. Police arrest over 800 students at the University of California at Berkeley following their takeover and sit-in at the administration building in protest of the UC Regents' decision to forbid protest on UC property. And now that same group, if you will, are trying to stop conservatives speaking on Berkeley campus. 1965, the launch of Gemini 7 with crew members Frank Borman and Jim Lovell. Gemini 7 spacecraft was the passive target for the first crewed space rendezvous performed by the crew of Gemini 6A. 1967, Vietnam War. U.S. and South Vietnamese forces engaged Viet Cong troops in the Mekong Delta. 1969, Black Panther Party members Fred Humpton and Mark Clark are shot and killed during a raid by 14 Chicago police officers. 1971, the Indian Navy attacks the Pakistan Navy in Karachi. 1971, the PNS Ghazi, a submarine belonging to the Pakistani Navy, sinks during the course of the Indo-Pakistani Naval War of 1971. Well, what goes up always comes down. What goes down doesn't always come up. And that was a lesson they learned. 1977, Jean Bedel Bokassa, president of the Central African Republic, crowns himself Emperor Bokassa I of the Central African Empire. 1977, Malaysia Airlines System Flight 653 is hijacked and crashes in Tanjung Kupang, Johor, killing 100. 1978, following the murder of Mayor George Moscone, Dianne Feinstein becomes San Francisco's first female mayor. 1979, the Hastie fire in Hull kills three schoolboys and eventually leads police to arrest Bruce George Peter Lee. 1981, South Africa grants independence to the Ciskei homeland, which is not recognized by any government outside South Africa. 1982, the People's Republic of China adopts its current constitution. 1983, U.S. Navy aircraft from the USS John F. Kennedy and USS Independence attack Syrian missile sites in Lebanon in response to an F-14 being fired on by an SA-7. One A-6 intruder and a 1A-7 Corsair are shot down. First American pilot was killed, and one was rescued, and one was captured. 1984, Sri Lankan Civil War. Sri Lankan soldiers kill 107 to 150 civilians in Manar. 1991, Terry Anderson is released after 7 years in captivity as a hostage in Beirut. He's the last and longest-held American hostage in Lebanon. 1991, Pan American World Airways ceases its operation after 64 years. 1992, Somali Civil War. President George H.W. Bush orders 28,000 U.S. troops to Somalia in Northeast Africa. 1998, the Unity Module, the second module of the International Space Station, is launched. 2005, tens of thousands of people in Hong Kong protest for democracy and call on the government to allow universal and equal suffrage. 2006, six black youths assault a white teenager in Jenna, Louisiana. 2014, Islamic insurgents killed three state police at a traffic circle before taking an empty school and a press house in Grozny. 10 state forces die, 28 are injured in gun battles, ending with 10 insurgents being killed. 2015, a firebomb is thrown into a restaurant in Egyptian capital Cairo. 17 people die. And in 2017, the Thomas Fire starts near Santa Paula in California. Eventually becomes the largest wildfire in Northern California history at that time. Burns 440 square miles in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. holidays and observances, Christian feast day, Ada, Año 2, Barbara, Barbarka, Miner's Day in Poland, Idi Il Berbara, a holiday similar to Halloween in honor of St. Barbara, celebrated in Russia, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, and Turkey, Bernardo degli Uberti, Clement of Alexandria in the Anglican Church, Giovanni Calabria, John of Damascus, Maruthus, Nicholas Ferrar in the Anglican Church, Osman, Sigiranus, earliest day on which Katinji can fall, December 10th is the latest, celebrated on Sunday, 2 weeks before Christmas in Serbia, National Cookie Day in the United States, in India it's Navy Day, the Thai Environment Day in Thailand, and Tapu One Day in Tonga. Well, with all that having been said, we've been talking about serial killers. Now, we had started talking about Gary Heidnik. In regard to him, with a little luck, a lot of lives might have been saved. On November 26, 1986, Sandra Lindsley, a mildly mentally disabled young African-American woman, lived in northern Philadelphia, went to the corner drugstore to get a package of Midol. Well, she was gone for hours, and when she didn't come back, her mother, Jeanette Perkins, went searching for her. She spent the entire weekend trying to find her daughter. On Monday, Perkins contacted a close friend of her daughter's, Cyril Tony Brown. Brown didn't know where she was, but he asked Jeanette whether she had tried the home of Gary Heidnik. Now, he was a white man in his early 40s who was a friend of both Sandra and Tony. And Sandra had been to Heidnik's house on numerous occasions. So Jeanette Perkins, still looking for her daughter, went over to Heidnik's house at 3520 North Marshall Street. It was a rundown house in a neighborhood that vaguely looked like Berlin after World War II and was nicknamed the OK Corral because of all the gunfights drug dealers had there. Heidnik had only paid $15,500 for the single-family home, and when it was appraised a year later, it was only worth $3,000. So she knocked on Heidnik's door but didn't get an answer, so after a while she went away, came back a couple of times that day, knocked, and still didn't get an answer. In fact, as she knocked, her daughter was inside the house. If Sandra had only screamed or if Jeanette had called the police, then the daughter might not have died. And then later on, there was this smell, an atrocious gagging kind of smell was coming from the house on Marshall Street, and it was so powerful it could be smelled along the entire block. Now, because Heidnik hadn't been seen for quite some time, the neighbors assumed the smell might be his rotting corpse, so they called the police. And a detective named El Ponte came to the house. He pounded on the door, and this time Gary Heidnik, a man described as having dark hair and dark eyes, opened the door. Aponte inquired as to the stench, and Heidnik said he'd just burned his dinner. Well, rather than investigating, the detective accepted the explanation, even though that stench had been permeating the neighborhood for days. If he hadn't accepted the explanation and demanded to be let in, things might have been different. Now, Heidnik was, in fact, cooking something, but it wasn't his dinner, but the ribcage of a human being. Now, the details as they came out later were to be some of the most shocking Philadelphia had ever imagined. In essence, Gary Heidnik ran a mini slave colony of African-American women in his basement. He kept them chained, abused, and he beat them, feeding them a blend of dog food and human flesh, which the starving women were forced into eating because they were just hungry. And he was sexually abusing them. It all started with Josefina Rivera, slim prostitute with a pretty hard face. November 26, 1986, she was working the corner of 3rd and Girard Street, trying to meet a John. And it was a miserable night for her. She'd had an argument with her boyfriend, Vincent Nelson. She didn't have any money. And in an hour or so, it'll be officially Thanksgiving Day. And it was a miserable, cold, damp, windy night. She was wearing a thin jacket and skin-tight blue jeans. So she was not anywhere near warm. She hoped she'd get at least one trick, but as time went by, her prospects got dimmer. There were a few cruising by that night. Then she noticed a Cadillac Coupe DeVille had stopped. The window lowered, and the driver, a middle-aged white man, asked her what she charged. She gave him a high figure, and they eventually settled on $20. So he invited her to get in the car, and she got in. He was dressed in a fringed leather jacket and wore a very expensive Rolex. The car was fairly new and heavily customized with chrome, so she figured he had money to spend. Told he's going to take it to his house, and they stopped to buy coffee, and then he drove at Daytona 500 speed through the empty, wet streets to his house on North Marshall. Now, his house was different from many houses in the area, and although it was run down, it stood alone and from most houses, which were attached to one another on one side, and had a dilapidated garage, which the other houses didn't. And inside that garage was a 1971 Rolls Royce. The garage doors were lined with steel to protect the car against shots from drug dealer shootouts. A few years earlier, Heidnik, who had a genius IQ and was brilliant at playing the stock market, paid $17,000 for that car. Withdrawal that hardly dented his money market account with Merrill Lynch, which had more than $500,000 in it. In the house, Heidnik brought Josephine upstairs to a bedroom, the dominant feature of which was a waterbed. He gave her the $20, took off his clothes, and got in bed with her. And they had intercourse for a while, and suddenly he grabbed her by the neck and started to choke her. Terrified, she said she'd do whatever he wanted if he'd let her live, so he took her downstairs to the first floor and then down another flight of stairs to a basement. And it was dark and dingy, had a dirt floor. Handcuffed her. Cuffs were secured to a chain, which in turn was linked to a metal bar that ran the length of the ceiling. She was pretty much locked up like an animal in a pen. And then he went upstairs and went to sleep. 3 days later, he brought another woman downstairs. She was African-American as well and plump. Her name? Sandra Lindsley. Like Josephina, he cuffed and chained her to the metal bar. And then the sex started. Every day from that point on, he had sex with both of them. And not only intercourse, but almost anything you can think of. He seemed insatiable and liked humiliating and dominating the women. He abused them physically, beating them for no apparent reason with his hands and with sticks. It wasn't long before the women were totally cowed and completely terrified of him. And he didn't exactly lay out a legal repast for them to eat either. Sometimes he gave them oatmeal for breakfast, sometimes Pop-Tarts or even crackers. For lunch, it'd be sandwiches. Sometimes. The special treat was takeout chicken. And he also offered them sandwiches made with dog food, which they ejected, but as her hunger deepened because he refused to feed them, they started eating the dog food sandwiches. And to make it worse, it was winter and the basement was chilly and damp. Neither woman was dressed warmly. Indeed, at one point, they were bare from the waist down. Well, 3 days before Christmas, 1986, he captured a new girl. Her name was Lisa Thomas, 19 years old, nice looking. She was walking down Lehigh Street with her life intersected with Heidnik's. He's cruising in his Cadillac, picked her up and offered to pay her for sex. And she says she wasn't a prostitute, just on the way to her girlfriend's house. Well, he said he'd give her a lift, and after some discussion, she decided he was harmless and got into the car. Before they got to where she wanted to go, he took her to a restaurant for a cheeseburger and fries, flashed a roll of bills, and asked if she wanted to go with him to Atlantic City. Well, when she responded she had nothing to wear for such an outing, he said he'd be happy to buy her whatever she wanted. Took her to a store and bought her an armful of jeans and blouses. Then they went to his house and had sex on his waterbed, and eventually she fell asleep. When she woke up, she asked Heidi to take her to her girlfriend's apartment. Well, at this point, he changed from a seemingly harmless man to something else. Grabbed her around the throat and choked her. The court later referred to this as the Heidnik maneuver. She begged him to stop and said she'd do whatever he wanted, so I took her down to the cellar and introduced her to the other two. And handcuffed her. And tied her to the bar that ran the length. Afterwards, he served peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, something of a treat, and completed his day's work by cuffing and chaining her to the metal bar, where she remained this time. His fourth captive was a woman named Deborah Dudley, and his fifth was 18-year-old Jacqueline Askins, taken just 4 days after Dudley. Askins was a prostitute, Dudley wasn't. It was midday when Heidnik, driving a blue Dodge van with imitation fur interior, picked Askins up. When he got her to her to his house, he drug her into the basement with the other captives watching, beat her, and then chained her up. He now had 5 prisoners in his basement. Some of them had been there for months. Well, sometimes during this process, he had devised a special punishment for those that didn't obey him, or he decided didn't or obey him. He dug a hole in the floor and covered it with a plywood panel. If he wanted to discipline somebody, he'd make her get into the hole and then cover the hole with plywood and weigh it down with sandbags. And his sexual activity with the prisoners continued and often involved humiliating the women. Dog food became the staple in the women's diet, but in spite of that, they all lost weight, and of course, hunger was with them all the time. But they didn't lack for music. He kept the radio blasting rock music 24 hours a day. That was one of the reasons why they had determined screaming wouldn't have helped him. Nobody could hear him over the music. Despite all of his activity, none of the women became pregnant, although there were a few false alarms when 2 missed their periods. Later, it would be determined that his main goal was to impregnate him. He viewed the basement as a kind of a baby farm. But unfortunately, he couldn't achieve his goal. Well, something eventually occurred that made the situation in the basement particularly terrifying for the abused women. Sandra Lindsley died. February 7th, 1987, she had a fever and was feeling very washed out. Didn't have any energy. He tried to force her to eat and realized she wasn't moving. In fact, she was dead. Well, if he was bothered by this event, he didn't show it, merely commenting she'd choked on a piece of bread. But he did have to get rid of her body. Carried her out of the room. Next thing the prisoners heard was the sound of a power tool. And they decided he was cutting her up, and they were right. He dismembered her, packed her parts in white plastic bags, and put them in the freezer. And then used a food processor to ground up some of the body. The parts he couldn't use, the head, hands, feet, rib cage, and bones, he tried to cook away. This was the burning flesh smell the neighbors complained about. And none of that cooked flesh went to waste. He started mixing it with dog food and fed it to his 2 dogs and then to the prisoners. Looking back, it wasn't known whether they knew they were eating human flesh or not, but they were so hungry it probably didn't matter. Of all the girls, Deborah Dudley was the most rebellious, and she battled his domination daily. Well, he realized he needed a special lesson to get Dudley to obey him. So one day he took her upstairs, opened the freezer, and showed her Sandra Lindsay's head and other body parts. Told her she didn't obey, she'd end up the same way. But she was tough. She continued to fight, and Hodnick finally devised a special torture for her. One night he put her in a hole, which he had partially filled with water, and plugged a wire into a long outlet and touched her hands with the bare end of the wire. Well, that pain was excruciating to the woman, and he repeated the torture as often as he wished. Ultimately, the pain killed her. Took one too many shocks and died. Instead of cutting her up, he dumped her body in the Pine Barrens in a New Jersey park, far from North Marshall Street. Well, Dudley's death did have a softening effect on Hodnick. He started to treat the women better, supplied them with blankets and pillows and even a television. But that didn't mean he stopped kidnapping others, though. On March 23rd, 1987, he captured 24-year-old Agnes Adams. He had paid her for sex on 2 prior occasions. The first time he couldn't get her into his house because someone had parked the car in front of his driveway, and the second time he paid her $35, and for some reason, unexplained reason, he let her go. The third time they met, she was working 5th and Girard Street. This time he brought her home, and before she knew it, she was locked up in the basement. Well, during the women's captivity, his first prisoner, Josefina Rivera, used her street-smart ways to gradually win his trust. In fact, he had shown her loyalty when he abducted Agnes Adams. He was in the car with Hodnick and encountered Adams for the third time. Agnes knew Josefina Vicky from the Hearts and Flowers strip joint. Josefina made no attempt to warn Agnes. She was dealing with a madman, so Agnes felt it was safe to get in the car with him. So when Josefina asked Hodnick if she could see her children and family, he said she could, but if she didn't return, all the other women would be killed. So he drove her into town, and she agreed to meet him at a gas station at midnight at 6th and Girard Street. And she said she'd bring another woman with her. Well, when he released her, Josefina Rivera immediately ran 4 blocks to the apartment of her boyfriend, Vincent Nelson. He was there, and she blurted out the whole story of where she'd been and the horrors at 3520 North Marshall Street. Well, the boyfriend, of course, was skeptical to such a bizarre story, but after a while, he began to believe her and told her to come with him. He was going to confront Heidnik at the gas station and beat him up. On the way over, though, he had second thoughts about how solid this plan was, so they called 911. The responding officers doubted the story as well until she showed him the marks made by the chains in the cuffs. So they all went to the gas station, found Gary Heidnik sitting there in his car waiting on her, and he was arrested. So March 25th, 1987, Philadelphia detectives, armed with a search warrant, went into the house. Downstairs, they found three women chained up in the basement. Two of them, Lisa Thomas and Jacqueline Laskins, were huddled under a blanket trying to keep warm. They screamed hysterically, and when they stood up, the blankets dropped off and showed they were nude from the waist down. They found Agnes Adams in the hole. She was nude and her hands cuffed behind her back. During a search of Heidnik's house, one detective got an unpleasant surprise. He found the packaged human flesh, the human fatty remains in a burned pan, and on a shelf in the freezer, a human forearm. All this could have been alleviated had that first detective insisted on searching the house. Well, Heidnik was born in Cleveland in 43 and had one sibling, a younger brother named Terry. His mother, Ellen, a nice-working woman who was part Native American, was an alcoholic who slept around. When Gary was 2 years old, his parents divorced, and after the divorce, Gary and his brother lived with their mother, but she soon seemed incapable of taking care of them. By the time they went into the first grade, the boys went to live with their father, Michael, who had remarried. They wouldn't live with their mother again, who married three more times before committing suicide by ingesting mercury in 1970. Gary described his father as cold and uncaring, a strict disciplinarian, but a psychiatrist who spoke to Gary said this description of the father is a gross understatement. Well, for example, when Gary or his brother went to bed, his father would hang the sheets out the window to show the world what bad little boys they were. We'd paint bullseyes on the brother's pants to show the other boys at school where to kick them. And if Terry or Gary are really bad, punishment could be just about anything, including being hung out the window by the ankles. Well, Gary's father was totally uncaring when it came to his sons. Indeed, when Gary was arrested, his father acted as if Gary had brought all this trouble on himself. When Gary was sentenced to death, his father, who hadn't talked to Gary for 25 years, said, "I'm not interested. I don't care. Don't bother me a bit. All I want is for you people to leave me alone. I don't care what happens." Well, Gary and Terry were in and out of mental institutions throughout their lives, and both brothers had tried to commit suicide on a number of occasions. Terry tried it just a few times, but Gary tried it 13 different times, using everything from driving his motorcycle into a truck to stockpiling Thorazine while he was in the hospital and trying to overdose on it. Well, growing up, Gary was extremely interested in the military and with finance. He actually attended a military high school for a couple of years. Been reading the financial pages since he was a kid, and as an adult, used his intellect and experience to amass a small fortune in stock. Well, he was arrested a few times for assault and did prison time, but overall, he spent the bulk of his years in mental institutions. Just about everybody who examined him considered him dangerous, schizophrenic, and incurable. One particular startling symptom was he sometimes went mute, didn't so much as say a word for almost 2 years. Well, he seemed to be afraid of women who were his intellectual equals and even women of average intelligence. Except for a brief marriage to a woman of average intelligence, for years he abducted women to be his slaves. Before he abducted the women to be his slaves, he became involved with women only who were intellectually inferior to him. In fact, one had an IQ of 49, probably a member of Congress. A person who had an IQ of 70 or so or below is considered to have mental retardation. This is part of a broader pattern of constantly getting involved with people who he felt were he was superior to. And where his father had power and superiority over him, Gary associated with people over whom he could feel powerful. Well, as you might guess, he was found guilty of murder and was sentenced to die in the electric chair. Before his execution, he was housed in a state correctional institution at Pittsburgh because of a change of venue granted to the defense during the trial. And since the age of 14, he'd been in 21 different mental institutions, tried to kill himself 13 times. You know, people who knew him very well predicted he'd try for number 14, but he never got that chance. He was executed July 6, 1999. Well, our next one, you've probably heard of, John Wayne Gacy. There were three images that jumped to mind about John Wayne Gacy. He ranks as one of the worst serial killers in the U.S. during the 20th century. Photo of the portly Gacy dressed and painted as a clown with a big clown smile on his face and a certain chilling light in his eyes. Then there's the picture of Gacy standing next to Rosalind Carter in 1978, which she actually autographed to John Gacy. Best wishes, Rosalind Carter. And finally, when the police searched his house, they found a 2-foot-long dildo, one of his torture implements, 18 inches of it covered with dried blood. He was, for lack of a better term, antisocial. Like most serial murderers, John Wayne Gacy was able to disguise the savagery inside him, the compulsion that made him kill. And part of his disguise included marrying twice and having children. John Wayne, he was named after John Wayne, the movie star. Gacy was born in 1942 in Edgewater Hospital in Chicago. He was the only boy in a family with a younger and older sister. In his family, there were not the obvious ruptures so common in the childhood of other serial killers, such as a father who abandons the family or a history of insanity. In fact, his family, for all intents and purposes, was a lot like the average family in this country. They lived a middle-class existence in middle-class Chicago. Well, while he grew up, something terrible was happening between him and his father. His father seemed obsessed with punishing little John, criticizing him, never allowing that his son could do anything right. And for years, they were at odds, and it was a lifelong regret of Gacy's he could never please his father. In fact, his father died while he was in jail. Gacy couldn't even get permission to attend the funeral. He was an ordinary kind of student in grade school and high school and never got into much trouble. His personality, though, developed a couple of noticeable quirks. He was a glad-handing kind of person with an aggressive style that turned some people off. But his biggest problem? He was a liar. He was always lying about his accomplishments, as if what he had really did wasn't good enough. Tried to make himself feel good, so he had to exaggerate. Never seemed to notice that a lot of folks knew he was lying. In fact, his tales were often so tall that it would have been impossible for him to have crowded into his life all the things he said he did. After high school, he briefly attended business school and became a salesman for the Nunn Bush Shoe Company in Springfield, Illinois. While he was working there, he met a pretty young woman named Marilyn Myers. They started a date and eventually asked her to marry him. Now, he was no matinee idol, of course. He was short, only 5'8". As I was saying, he was no matinee idol. He was short, 5'8", had a weight problem, a large belly, but he was persuasive and generous and nice to be around, so she said yes. So they were married in September of 1964. Well, Marilyn's parents bought a string of Kentucky Fried Chicken stores soon after the couple married, and they wanted the young couple to manage them. So they agreed and moved into the Elder Myers home in Waterloo, Iowa. And their life seemed to be blessed. I mean, Marilyn bore a son and then a daughter. The couple lived comfortably and worked hard. Gacy also became active in the Waterloo chapter of the JCs, a civic group devoted to bettering their communities with a wide variety of activities. He had done this in Springfield, achieving quite a lot of success, earning a number of awards from the JCs for his work. And this sort of life would be enough to satisfy most people, but Gacy kept lying. He worked hard at the job, 7 days a week till 10 or 11 at night, but he continued his self-aggrandizement. One point he claimed to be a relative of the person who founded the fried chicken chain. He not only liked to seem important, but also liked to look the part. One manifestation of this was his car, which he equipped with a siren and police lights. It was only later that his more sinister purpose would be revealed. But there had been rumors. There were some nasty rumors circulating claiming Gacy was propositioning having sex with some of the teenage boys that worked in the restaurants he married. It was charged he gave the best-looking boys. He seemed to like light-haired boys with muscle bodies, rides home, favored him in other ways as well. And then a boy named Mark Miller brought charges against Gacy. Miller said Gacy had forced him to perform deviant sexual acts with him. Gacy denied it, but an investigation showed they'd been involved with each other and there were other boys as well. One of these boys, James Tullery, detailed a terrifying ordeal. Tullery had been at Gacy's house, and after plying Tullery with booze and pornographic films, he tried to force him to perform sex acts. To do this, he had threatened him, Tuileri, cut him with a knife, shackled him, choked him, almost to the point of unconsciousness. Now, nothing happened, and Gatesy eventually released the boy. He's lucky to get out alive. Well, the judge in Miller's case, mindful of Gacy's perverse patterns, sentenced him to 10 years at the Iowa State Reformatory in Atomosa. So at the age of 26, John Wayne Gacy was in jail. His wife filed divorce papers soon after that, and ultimately he was to lose her, the house, and his kids. Didn't seem to matter much to him because he apparently never contacted her or the kids again. Well, he brought the same verve and vigor to the prison world that he had brought to his fried chicken restaurants, and prison officials actually thought highly of him. After only 8 months of his 10-year sentence, he just got parole. Freed, he moved into a house in Chicago with his 61-year-old mother and her sister and got a job as a fast food cook. Then asked the Iowa Parole Board for permission to move to Chicago. And because of his seemingly stable life, including a job, the board granted his request. Well, he moved around as a cook, but was doing well for himself, so well, he decided to buy a house. Help of his mother, who provided half the financing, he bought a small two-bedroom ranch at 8213 West Summerdale Avenue in Norwood, which is a middle-class suburban community not far from the northwest side of Chicago. The house was on a one-way westbound street and didn't get a great deal of traffic. Most of the people traveling down it were heading home, and it was a typically suburban brick house with a garage, front, and backyards. The most significant feature about this house, as it turned out later, was the crawl space underneath it. It had 4-foot-high concrete walls and a dirt floor. To gain access to it, there was a trap door on the floor of the bedroom closet. John Wayne Gacy passed through that trap door a lot of times. Well, he made friends with his neighbors at the new house, particularly the Grexa family next door, had 6 children. They noticed he was always working around the house, seemed to like doing that type of work a lot. He didn't stay a bachelor for long. On June 1, 1972, he married Carol Hoff, a divorcee with 2 kids, and settled into suburban life at his house. 1974, he formed PDM Contractors. The letter stood for painting, decorating, and maintenance, and started remodeling commercial properties. But it wasn't all blissful at home, even though his commercial life was doing well. His relationship with his wife deteriorated to the point she filed for divorce. Later on, she explained he was sexually impotent and had a quick, dangerous temper. One minute he'd be cool, calm, and collected, next he'd be in a rage and breaking furniture. Gacy also told his wife what he called a minor detail about himself. He liked boys as well as women. Well, while unsuccessful in marriage, though, his contracting business was doing very well. He worked extremely hard, finished jobs early, made sure customers were satisfied. And his work crews consisted of 2 types of people, experienced older craftsmen and teenage boys who worked as laborers. And he often invited the better-looking boys home to watch stag films where they'd drink and smoke marijuana. Well, from time to time, Gacy did have brushes with the law, but no other convictions came his way. One boy complained to the police. Gacy had ordered him into his car one night, saying he was a deputy sheriff, and then had forced him to perform oral sex. After Gacy demanded the boy do it again, the boy refused and jumped out of the car and ran. Gacy tried to run him down, but the boy escaped. Lucky for Gacy, Iowa parole authorities didn't find out, and pretty soon he didn't have to worry. On June 18, 1976, his parole from the Iowa prison was up, and he couldn't have been brought up on parole violation charges after that. Well, he was too old to work for the J.C.'s in Chicago, but he wasn't too old for politics. So he got involved in local politics, ingratiating himself with politicos by providing the services of PDM free of charge. Maybe the high point of his political achievements was when he got to pose for that picture with Rosalynn Carter. At one point after Gacy moved into Summerdale, his neighbors, the Grexon, noted an objectionable odor around his house and never really left during all the time he lived there. It was a thick, foul smell. When they asked about it, Gacy said it was probably something wrong with the sewer lines. And because the Grexon also had trouble with their sewer lines, they really didn't follow up on it. The smell, of course, wasn't sewage. From time to time, he had killed a young man and carried his body through the trap door in the closet and buried in a shallow grave. And then he'd cover the bodies with lime to hasten decomposition. Later investigation revealed that Gacy trapped his victims in a variety of ways. One way was by posing as a police officer, as he did with the young man I talked about a few moments ago. He'd purchased a black 1978 Oldsmobile Delta equipped with a searchlight on the side, and he'd often cruise the gay neighborhoods of Chicago. Young men, particularly young gay men, felt they couldn't say no to a police officer and would immediately get in the car. Or he'd simply pick up street hustlers and pay for sex, and then sometimes he'd kill them. Well, the most dangerous situation for anybody to be in with John Wayne Gacy was at his home. And he had a couple of ways to trap young men there. One was chloroform. He'd catch the person off guard and hold a chloroform-soaked rag to his nose till he collapsed. And once the boy was incapacitated, Gacy'd cuff him. Another way he got was the handcuff trick. He'd produce what he said were toy handcuffs and challenge the person to put him on an escape. Of course, they were real, and the victim couldn't escape, and then Gacy would rape, torture, and maybe kill him. Though not always. One street hustler named Jaime described a very close call with Gacy. He said he was led into the bedroom. And both of them would strip. And Gacy told him to get busy with what he was paid to do, but before he could, he was hit. Suddenly, he was being beaten. He tried to scream, but he was choked to smother the noise. Boy managed to get free, but Gacy did something that terrified him even more. From somewhere, he produced a pair of handcuffs. Jaime picked up a vase and shattered it over Gacy's head, and moments later, Jaime was lifted off his feet and thrown onto the bed. Then the man jumped on top of him and smashed him into the mattress. But for some unaccountable reason, Gacy didn't kill this particular young man, sent him on his way with $50, 20 more than he agreed to pay, and seemed to regard the whole thing as a joke. Now, in retrospect, it's amazing Gacy wasn't caught before he was. Young boys were disappearing in the area at an alarming rate, and his name even came up in various investigations at different police stations. But there was often no communication between different police jurisdictions, and none of them thought to see whether he had a criminal record or not. If they had, they would have discovered his conviction in Iowa for sodomy, and that might have saved a lot of lives. It's also amazing none of the neighbors suspected anything. One woman who lived in a house a block away said she'd occasionally hear faint screams coming from the house in the dead of night, but neither she nor anybody else thought to do anything about it. And of course, there was that sickening odor that never really went away. It took the murder of Robert Peast and a determination and skill of one police officer to derail Gacy's murderous train. Robert Peast was a 16-year-old All-American high school boy who, in December 1978, was working in a Nissen pharmacy in Des Plaines, Illinois. He's making $2.85 an hour. His mother came to pick him up one night at 9 o'clock, and Robert asked her to wait in the store while he talked with a contractor about a job to pay him $5 an hour in the summer. He was saving to buy a car, and the job was quite attractive. Well, Peast went out a few minutes after 9 and never returned. His mother went outside the pharmacy to look for him, and he had vanished. Next day, Lieutenant Joseph Kozinczak was looking over missing person reports and came across the report his mother had filed about Peast. He spoke with the boy's mother, ascertained he wasn't a runaway, and launched a full-scale investigation. One part of the investigation led to Gates, who denied ever having seen the boy. However, unlike other police officers before him, Kozinczak had done a routine background check on Gacy, which included a check for any prior criminal record. And the check revealed the Iowa conviction and prison sentence. So he convinced the judge there was probable cause to issue a search warrant, and police descended on the house at 8213 West Summerdale. They found pornographic gay films, literature, and other material in the trunk of the car. That black Oldsmobile, they found hair that matched that of Robert Peast. Well, the hair wasn't sufficient for an arrest, so police started open surveillance on Gacy that drove him crazy. And then there was another break. Police had taken a roll of film from Gacy's house during the search, and when they got around to developing it, they discovered it belonged to Robert Peast. Well, Kozinczak was sure Gacy was his man. When one of the investigators entered Gacy's house with a second search warrant, he got lucky. If it was a police officer, the detective to work in a place where the smell in Gates' house was routine. The morgue. Police obtained another warrant, started taking up floorboards and digging into the earth in the crawl space. Well, that digging took 2 weeks of very careful archaeological type searching. When it was over, police had uncovered 27 bodies, and Gates had confessed to killing another 5, which he dumped into the Plains River. That was the final resting place of Robert Peace, who was found in a river several months later. Autopsy revealed paper towels had been jammed in his throat. He had actually suffocated. There was a question whether Gatesy was mentally fit to stand trial, but Judge Louis Garippo determined he was. Psychologists for the defense testified that Gatesy was a paranoid schizophrenic, didn't have control over his actions, but that wasn't enough to save him. He was found guilty of the murder of 33 young men and sentenced to die by lethal injection. He was shipped down to the Menard Correctional Center in Menard, Illinois, where for a time he was the only inmate in the death row cell block. Illinois authorities said they received hundreds of requests from citizens all over the U.S. asking for the pleasure of injecting him. The Menard Prison in southern Illinois, about 50 miles south of St. Louis on the Mississippi River, has a panoramic view of the river and surrounding countryside. In fact, it may have the most scenic view of any prison in the Illinois system. Gacy became a portrait painter during his time on death row. He painted mostly clowns. He'd paint clowns in all kinds of scenes and sold them for a handsome price to prison officials cracked down on the practice. May 10, 1994, he was executed by lethal injection. Well, you know, sometimes people collect odd things. Jonathan Davis, the lead vocalist for the heavy rock group Korn, is an avid collector of crime memorabilia, and his special interest is items related to serial killers. Davis, who was a former mortuary science student, admits he was always drawn to the dark side, and at one time he planned to open a museum dedicated to crime items with a special emphasis on serial murders. He owns a great deal of memorabilia, including original artwork from John Wayne Gacy and Richard Ramirez. The highlight of his collection, though, are two Pogo the Clown suits once owned by Gacy when he entertained at children's parties, and he also has the yellow VW Volkswagen that Ted Bundy drove when he was out looking for victims. Well, it's interesting to note that in many cases, the serial killer, who's really not smarter than anybody else, but they seem to get the breaks, like when the officer refused to follow up on his investigation of the strange odor. Because, after all, they have hard jobs and they get tired and somebody says everything's fine, okay, fine. It's the thoroughness of investigators that can stop these things. Our next one is Albert DeSalvo, who may or may not have been the Boston Strangler. Well, we've come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be back once again at our usual time. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great weekend.